If you're a good gardener, the Iowa Master Gardener Program can make you great. Today, we'll find out what a master gardener is, what it takes to become one, and what master gardeners have to offer to the rest of us. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today. Cindy Haynes will be here. She's an associate professor of horticulture at Iowa State University and the professor in charge of the Iowa Master Gardener Program. We'll talk about the education and training opportunities for interested gardeners and some of the projects around the state that have been made possible by master gardeners. Richard Geron of Iowa State University Extension will also be with us today. He and Cindy will answer your questions. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and as usual, we will be answering your questions about the plants in your life in a few minutes. But first, we're going to talk about an opportunity that gardeners in the state have to take their skills to the next level. Cindy Haynes is an associate professor of horticulture at Iowa State University. She's also the professor in charge of the Iowa Master Gardener Program. Hello, Cindy.
Good morning.
Thanks for coming back today. And what is a master gardener?
Well, a master gardener is a volunteer through Iowa State University Extension and Outreach in the Department of Horticulture. And their mission is to help educate others in their community about gardening and gardening practices so that they're more efficient, they're better at gardening, and then everyone can experience and enjoy the passion of growing plants.
And if somebody wants to become a master gardener, what are they getting themselves into?
Well, it's a pretty intense training, and they are getting themselves into quite a bit of training. It's usually 40 hours of training, most of this through webcast sessions at their local county extension office and even a class on campus day. Then after that, they're considered a master gardener intern, and they're not considered a full master gardener until after they donate or contribute 40 hours of volunteer service in their local community.
Does somebody have to go through an application process to apply for the program to show that they're qualified to become a master gardener?
There usually is an application process. It doesn't mean that you have to know a lot about gardening to begin with. We have many gardeners or many master gardeners that start out knowing very little. In that 40 hours of training, you get a lot of information. You also, when you're volunteering, you're usually working with another master gardener that helps mentor you through that process. So you learn a lot that first year. There's also an application fee as well of $150.
So with the application fee, though, does that cover all of those hours of training?
It does. It covers all those hours of training. It covers the class on campus, including a lunch when we come to class on campus. So it's for the entire 2 months of or more of training.
So who is a good applicant? Who's a good prospect for a master gardener?
Those that really enjoy gardening or really want to learn more about gardening, those who like to help others in their community, and those that have the time or can find the time to contribute both those 2 evenings a week during the fall or winter, and then can contribute that 40 hours of training or volunteer service later in the year.
Give me an idea of some of the subjects that would be covered in the webcasts.
In the webcast, we start off with botany and soil, so we start off with some of the basics. We also have plant pathology, entomology. We talk about landscape trees and shrubs. We have herbaceous ornamentals. We have, turf grass. We also have fruits. I'm kind of phasing out on some of these. Oh, there's 8 or 9 of them. So vegetable crops as well, wildlife, as well as pest management and weeds. So there's quite a few every Tuesday evening, 3-hour sessions, usually at your local county extension office.
Is the subject matter similar to what you would be teaching to students in horticulture at Iowa State?
It is very similar. Sometimes I use some of that same information in my home horticulture class to kind of give them the foundation of what horticulture is and a little bit of information about, say, each of these different topics. Obviously, with the Master Gardeners, when you have a three-hour session on turf grass, it can be a little more in-depth than just that introductory horticulture class.
And with your students, of course, you get to test them to make sure that they're absorbing the information that you're presenting. How do you know that the people who are involved in the Master Gardener program are learning?
Well, we do know. We do some evaluation, so that's part of the process. We also have little self-quizzes at the end of each section where they, you know, after they've learned about turf grass, they go home and they fill out this little self-quiz, which are sometimes multiple choice, sometimes open-ended. Sometimes even matching or fill in the blank. And then the next time they come for a session, we spend the next 5 minutes before the next speaker going over some of those answers. And Master Gardeners really love that because they like that quizzing. They like that, did we learn something? And they love sharing that, oh, I got this one right, and oh, you didn't, kind of a thing. So they're some of our best students.
Sure, I'm sure they're very motivated learners if they've volunteered to be a part of the program.
Right. They're very enthusiastic learners.
So when you talk about the volunteer hours put in by Master Gardeners after they complete the program, when they're in the intern stage, it has to be 40 hours. But, of course, after they become official Master Gardeners, there are many other hours of volunteering that take place. What kind of projects do Master Gardeners do?
Right. So after they're a full Master Gardener and contribute that 40 hours, then their volunteer service to maintain that active status is 12 hours of volunteer service a year and 6 hours of continuing education. And some of the things they do in that 12 hours of volunteer service might be helping with like the Discovery Garden at the State Fair. Polk County Master Gardeners do a really good job there. They might do plant sales. They might grow plants for scholarships or other purposes. They do things like work with youth or have demonstration gardens or teach youth or even teach others across the community through presentations or workshops. Every county does it a little bit differently. And I think that's what makes it so unique is that there's, you know, at least half a dozen different opportunities in every county. And some of them are very focused on presentations and education. Some are on beautification as well and education through that. And then hands-on, because everyone who's a Master Gardener just really likes plants and getting dirty.
How much of a network is there? It sounds like a lot of this could be very individual work, but also, you know, you look at the Discovery Garden at the State Fair. Clearly, that's a very public project, and and there, I'm sure there's a group organization at the head of that. So how much of a network is there among Master Gardeners in the state?
Well, there's about 3,000 active Master Gardeners in Iowa, so it's quite a network. And within each of the counties, they often have smaller groups that have certain projects, and we've learned through Master Gardener training that learning with this group tends to be very social. So they work on projects together in smaller groups, and then their county group gets together usually once a month, and they decide on future projects. So it tends to be very interactive and very social and pretty big network.
If there's a project that somebody really needs help on, is there like a Master Gardener signal that you can
we don't have any smoke signals or the bat signal, no, but they do. They're very connected. We connect with them through email, and there's coordinators in each of the counties that help kind of, you know, say, okay, well, such and such needs help here. Who can help her out, or can someone else help them out? So they're really, like I said, well connected. And very savvy on what needs to be done.
You mentioned 6 hours of continuing education. What kind of continuing education opportunities are there?
Well, the counties offer some different presentations, particularly in the winter. When we can't get outside and garden as much, they might have a speaker that comes into the county office. Public gardens offer some of these education opportunities. ISU Extension through us as well. Department of Horticulture has some of those opportunities as well. There's lots of opportunities and lots of things that would count for that continuing education.
But what kinds of things might you cover in continuing education? Would that be where you do an update on new pests, or is it getting into just more intricate details?
It's usually getting a little more into intricate details, and it might be focusing on one particular area. So there might be a garden seminar or workshop that the county is putting on or a group of counties are putting on. So they might learn more about herbs or they might learn more about youth, or they might go to a conference like the Shade Tree Short Course or the Turf Conference and kind of target some of those specifics. So there's plenty of opportunities and plenty of ideas.
I can imagine someone listening and thinking, well, I do love to garden. I love mm-hmm. to connect with other gardeners. But that's a major commitment when mm-hmm. you think about the time, not just in the first year, but as time goes on as well. Why become a master gardener?
Most master gardeners will tell you that they love gardening a lot, but they love connecting with people equally as much. And so with they kind of have that connection of both of those passions of seeing others learn more about gardening and seeing it, their eyes light up when they tell them something unique. So spreading the word and sharing their passion is what keeps them volunteering. And it also helps right now with master gardeners, you know, telling people how to grow plants better or how to grow their food better and seeing that kind of impact. So I think it's that volunteering impact that they see, and that's why they continue to do it.
Do you have a favorite master gardener project that you've seen come to pass in the last few years?
In the last week or two, my favorite master gardener project has been hiring a new coordinator. So, which is a little bit off subject, but he's here, Charity. I don't know if you...
Oh, no, I didn't know that.
You know that he's here, but our new master gardener coordinator is Dr. Dennis Schrock, and he's here, and that's probably been my favorite project for this summer. But every county has a project that's just absolutely fascinating. They do something a little bit unique or a little bit different, and they fit it to what that county actually needs. So.
Is Dr. Schrock on the microphone?
I am here.
Hi there. Yeah.
Hello, Charity.
welcome aboard. And what, just briefly, what's your background?
Well, my very targeted Master Gardener background is that I previously was State Master Gardener Coordinator in Illinois and Missouri for a total of 8 years. But for the last 10 years, I've been a garden editor with Meredith Corporation in Des Moines. So I've gotten to know Iowa pretty well by living here for the last 10 years as well.
Well, terrific. And is yours a voice that we'll get to hear on Hort Day in the future?
I would imagine so, yes.
Yes, I would imagine so.
I can imagine that Richard Duran, who's also in the studio, is shaking his head. Yes, quite
yes,
emphatically.
Yes, that's correct.
We have another one to add to the plate.
Oh, wonderful. All right, well, in just a moment, it's time to start answering questions. And Dr. Schrock, I hope you'll participate as well today if you're feeling ready.
We'll go for it.
Okay.
I used to have a radio program, too.
Oh, well, then you're prepared. The number to call to ask your questions is 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.com. You can leave a message on our Facebook page as well, if you'd prefer. With me today, Cindy Haynes. She's an associate professor of horticulture at Iowa State University. Dennis Schrock, who is now the new coordinator for the Iowa Master Gardener Program. And, of course, Richard Duran, horticulturist with Iowa State University Extension. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nubby. It's Horticulture Day today, and we are ready to answer your questions at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk, or you can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Richard Duran is here from Iowa State University Extension. Good morning, Richard.
Good morning.
Nice to have you back again today. And Cindy Haynes is also with us. She's an associate professor of horticulture at Iowa State University. And joining us today is Dennis Schrock, who is the new Master Gardener Coordinator. And you're welcome to join our conversation. First on the line is Corrine in Radcliffe. Hi, Corrine.
Hi.
Hi, what's your question?
I have a question about two trees. One was planted about 2006 or 7, the other at 2010. And they just are not doing, have not done well at all. They are red maples. I think the first one was called October Glory. Mm-hmm. And I'm just wondering if they are really suited for Iowa soils and climate.
Sometimes they have problems. It is a true red maple, and they're not native to Iowa. And sometimes if the soils are not quite right, if they're very alkaline, if they're kind of a clay-type soil, they do have some problems. So,
well, we had clay-type soil because we built a new home, and you know what that entails. Mm-hmm.
So nowadays, you'll see quite a few of the silver maple-red maple hybrids because they tend to perform much better than the red maples.
I see.
Things like Autumn Blaze, for example, a very, very common variety. If they're still growing, I wouldn't give up. This past summer has been extremely stressful, and I would...
I've watered them a lot. I mean,
okay.
I let the hose seep for an hour or two, just, you know, around them. And but their leaves are turning yellow, and I've sprayed them last year and this year also with iron.
Right.
To help with that, and now the leaves are... burned all around the edge like mm-hmm. a blight or something.
Right. Well, in an alkaline soil, they're not able to absorb enough iron. There's plenty of iron in the ground. They just can't absorb it. And if you simply add more iron to the soil, that doesn't correct that very well. And it's very, very hard to change the pH. What you may want to try is maybe find a chelated iron product.
Say that again.
Chelated, C-H-E-L-A-T-E-D. That mm-hmm. iron tends to be in a form they can absorb more readily.
Well, and I think that's what I have in this spray I use.
Okay.
I think it's chelated.
That's the best you can do. And if the plants don't respond, maybe it's time to pull the plug in a couple years if they don't respond well.
Okay. And Autumn Blaze was the name of the hybrid, and
right.
you thought maybe it would work better.
Well, they tend to because they're part silver maple, part red maple, and so they have that vigor of the silver maple.
Uh-huh.
They have the nice fall color of the red maple, and
okay.
so they tend to perform better than the true red maples. Autumn
All
Blaze
right.
is one of several different varieties, and so I would look for one of those hybrids possibly in the future.
All right, Kareen, thank you for your call, and good luck with that. And Richard, although clearly she has a more serious problem, we are seeing a lot of leaves changing on trees
right.
already, and we're just going to see a lot of that this
right.
year, right?
Because they're under stress. That's one of those signs when you see something unusual, like early leaf coloration, early leaf drop, that's a sign of a tree in stress. And it's basically just shutting down early just because of the extreme heat and drought of this past summer.
Okay. Doug is on the line next from the Quad Cities at 866-780-9100. Hello, Doug.
Hello. My question is this. About 15 years ago, I put in a raised bed, 4 by 8 feet, sort of on the edge of a ravine, and planted raspberry plants. They have never done particularly well. I get lots of buds in the spring. Lots of things look like they're going to become raspberries, and mostly they just shrivel up and go away. And I'm wondering if it's time to just say, that's not a good place for raspberries. Dig it all up and plant something else.
Those plants, did you buy plants, or were they obtained from an old bed?
No, I bought them.
Hmm.
They've
well,
never done well.
Okay. Yeah, I would be inclined to pull the plug. I'd get rid of them and start over.
Okay, look start with raspberries or something else?
I think I'd look for a different site for the raspberries.
Okay.
Make sure the site receives at least 6 hours of direct sun,
uh-huh.
and you have a good, well-drained soil. That's basically all the raspberries need.
Okay.
I'm not sure what's wrong with the current plants. Sometimes when you obtain older plants from a old patch,
uh-huh.
they might be diseased.
Mm.
And therefore not productive. But when you buy plants from a nursery or garden center, they're typically certified disease-free, so that shouldn't be the issue.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks a lot for your call, Doug. Next up we have, let's see, it's Jennifer on the line in Des Moines. Hi, Jennifer.
Oh. Hi, how are you?
Good.
I was lucky enough to get an old rose bush from a neighbor. That one did beautiful. It's about probably 6 foot tall. It has big thorns, but then I went out, went rose crazy, and I bought, it's Cordis Perfecta Rose, and I bought the Rosa Electron and just the rose shrub. I'm
mm-hmm.
wondering, how do I care for those in the wintertime? Do I prune them all the way down? What do I do?
Typically with the modern roses, we do not prune those in the fall.
Okay.
But in the Des Moines area around Thanksgiving, I would take some soil, maybe from a garden bed, and I would cover the bottom 8 to 12 inches of the rose canes so they have protection. Because if they don't have protection and we have a really cold winter, you could lose them because they're not as hardy as some of the shrub-type roses. And so I would do that around Thanksgiving and then basically just leave them as they are and then prune them back in the spring, cut out the dead wood at that point.
Okay, gotcha. And one more quick question. I have Rose of Sharon, and I have tons of buds, but they're not blooming. What's the problem? I've used a bud releaser, and nothing seems to help.
Have you been watering?
Oh, like crazy. I have a $400 water bill.
So you've been watering this Rose of Sharon?
Yes.
Have you fertilized it lately?
Have we fertilized them? No, we haven't.
Okay, so it's not high nitrogen. That's good. That's good.
So they're forming flower buds, but they're not opening.
And we just used a bud releaser and nothing.
Okay. Are they developing color at all?
Yes, they are.
But they're just not opening.
They're not opening.
Possibly there might be an insect like a thrip, possibly. I don't know if that does happen sometimes, especially in hot, dry weather.
Is it a little black bug?
Well, the thrip is very, very tiny, almost invisible to the naked eye. It's very, very tiny. But they basically suck sap from the plant tissue, and they're kind of fond of flower tissue because the flower tissue is very succulent, very tender. And if you took let's say you pinched off a flower and then brought it inside and laid it on a piece of, let's say, black paper, and then very carefully tore that flower apart, you might actually see the little thrip on the paper against that dark background. And if you saw many of them, that would be an obvious the cause. So,
okay, what's the solution?
Well, thrips are hard to control, unfortunately. And you can't really do anything this year. Hopefully, if we have better weather conditions where we have more regular rains in the spring and summer, that the thrips wouldn't be a major problem.
So you may have perfectly fine flowers next year.
Right.
Okay. Thank you so much.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call, Jennifer. You can join our conversation at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. It's Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa, and with me are Cindy Haynes, she's an associate professor of horticulture at Iowa State University, Richard Gerond from Iowa State University Extension, and also Dennis Schrock, who's the new coordinator of the Master Gardener Program at Iowa State University. And let's go to an email question. This is from Nisa. She says, I've been trying to reclaim an old perennial bed using Roundup to kill grass and other perennial weeds. Mm-hmm. This has worked great, except where vinca and periwinkle have taken over. Roundup does not even touch it, and I'm unable to dig or hoe such a large garden at my age, so weed killers need to be used. I have not tried 2,4-D or any other weed killers. Do you have any other suggestions?
Well, I think Roundup would be the most effective, more effective than 2,4-D or dicamba. If the Roundup is not working and they can't dig, I guess one possibility would be to cover it with like a tarp or something and leave it covered for quite some time. And eventually the lack of light of the plant would die. So they could try that.
All right, and that might be a little less labor intensive.
But it would have to be covered for several months.
And this time of year, covering it also has the effect of heat sterilization almost of the soil or pasteurization of the soil. So this time of year is a good time to do that.
Right, because you might be killing some other weed seeds as well.
So putting that on right now and leaving it on, say, for the winter, would put her in good shape for next spring?
I'm not sure if there's enough time right now. I mean, if between now and winter. Maybe Donna, I'm not sure. Now, if they had done it, let's say, around May, I would think by September everything should be dead. Okay. But I'm not sure about right now starting it.
Okay, so maybe that's something she should think about for next year.
Right.
All right. Let's go to the next call. This is Jenna on the line in Cedar Rapids. Hi.
Hi. I usually trim my spirea after they bloom, in the spring. this year they look particularly bad and kind of stressed probably from the lack of water. However, I have been watering them, but I'm wondering, should I just leave them be and wait till later in the fall at this point to trim them, and or maybe just wait till next spring to trim them?
Which type are they? Do they have pink flowers or white flowers?
They have pink.
Pink. What I would do is wait, and I would cut them back in March or April before they leaf out. And you can cut them back severely. Actually, they tend to like that every 3 or 4 years because they kind of get straggly and unkempt looking.
So how clean them out with deadwood, and then how far down do I cut them?
I would probably cut them back to within 3 to 4 inches of the ground.
Really? Okay.
Start them over because they kind of like that. They will come back and grow back quite vigorously. They'll still bloom later on that summer. Not much, but they'll still bloom. And usually they'll look a lot better by the end of that summer.
Okay. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call, Jenna. And next up, let's go to Liz on the line in Des Moines. The number to call for you to join our conversation is 866-780-9100. Hi, Liz. Liz, are you there?
Yes. Oh, hi.
Hi.
Thank you. So I have a question about boxwoods and potentially spider mites. We bought 6 boxwoods in May, I think, and planted them, and they were really thriving and doing great and growing and nice for the first 8 weeks or so. The only problem is we would have these really tightly woven spider webs along the tops of them. Almost every day we'd have to pick them out. And now in the last few weeks, the leaves been turning brown, like a, you know, goldish brown, and they just look like they're dying, and it's getting very sad. And we took pictures and went back to the store where we got them, and the guy there told us that he thinks we have spider mites that are killing the bushes.
Well,
so how do we know if that's what it is?
Spider mites are very, very tiny. Again, you need almost something like a solid background where you take that paper and you hold it below a branch, and then you shake the branch, and then you look for these tiny little specks about the size of a pepper grain moving about on the paper.
Okay.
When you see those are spider mites.
And are they red?
They can be.
They can be various colors. Oftentimes they're kind of a
greenish
or tannish color, kind of neutral.
Okay.
But they're very, very tiny. And you will see some very fine webbing, but just very fine webbing. Not like a spider web, but just some very fine webbing. And so that's what you look for. And
but is the fine webbing, is it really dense? Because it's sort of fine threads, but it's densely
usually
together.
It's a little more open, a little more scattered,
right,
and kind of in between the leaves, not necessarily at the top of the plants. It might be in between the leaves and the stems, kind of lower in the plant.
And that it's usually pretty closely attached to the leaves and stem. It doesn't spread from one stem to another over a long distance like regular spider webs do.
So what you might have just a regular spider, you know, that's making some nice webs on the top.
But that's on, it's on all 6, the spider webs are on all 6 of our bushes, and now 4 of them look like they're almost dead.
Well, if they are spider mites, one way to deal with them is to just go out with the garden hose and spray the plants forcibly with the garden hose.
Okay.
Spider mites tend to be more of a problem in a hot, dry year because nothing is controlling the population. And they thrive in the heat. So
it's been a good year for spider
mites. It's been a good year for them.
Sorry.
It's also been a difficult year for the actual boxwoods to get established. I mean, you would hope that you have a good year, you plant them, and they get adjusted very quickly. But this year has been very tough. So they have that going against them, too. So I guess I would be out there watering them on a regular basis, about once a week or so.
Mm-hmm.
And if you do that, I would just turn the hose on the plants and just spray them real hard.
Okay.
You could use insecticidal soap also.
Yeah, we've done that.
Okay, so that's what I would do as far as, and with these plants, I would keep on watering into November if it's dry.
Okay.
Because the first winter typically is always the worst, the most difficult for that plant. And they retain their foliage in winter, so make sure they have a chance to absorb some water this fall.
Okay. And so if it is spider mites and we aren't able to get on top of that before the winter, will that just kill, will the bushes be done?
Well, hopefully that's not the case. it could be, if they don't survive, it might be multiple things where you have the spider mites, you have the hot, dry weather. You simply have so many stresses they can't cope, they can't get established, and they may not survive, but probably a combination of things.
Liz, thanks a lot for your call. And we have to go to a break here in just a second, but, you know, I've started seeing the flyers from the landscaping centers with all of their fall sales, considering how incredibly dry it is. I know, Richard, sometimes you have misgivings about planting in the fall anyway. Is there something special we should be thinking about after this dry, dry summer?
Boy, when you plant something, it's kind of, you have to water anyway. That's kind of a given. So if you do find something on sale, whatever, if it's good quality, I think I'd still go ahead and plant, but just make sure that you water those plants into November so they have plenty of moisture.
Okay. Richard Giron, Iowa State University Extension Horticulture. Cindy Haynes is also here, an associate professor of horticulture at Iowa State University. Dennis Schrock, the new Master Gardener Coordinator at Iowa State University. And, of course, we'll be taking your calls in a moment, 866-780-9100. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today. And with me in the studio, Cindy Haynes, an associate professor of horticulture at Iowa State University, Richard Giron, Iowa State University Extension, and Dennis Schrock, who is the new coordinator for the Iowa Master Gardener Program. And you're welcome to join us with your questions, 866-780-9100. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And the next one, Randy in Iowa County. Hi, Randy.
Hi there.
What's your question today?
Let's see. I got three. My pears seem to be doing well that I sell at the Iowa City Farmers Market, but I've talked to one or two other people that said that their apples, they didn't distinguish what kind, were kind of soft and punky on the inside. Third question is this dry weather going to affect the walnut crop and the hickory nuts and the acorns?
Well, as far as the fruit crop, we just, in Iowa in general, we have a very poor fruit crop because we had the freezing temperatures in April, around April 10th and 11th, and that destroyed many of the flowers. So many growers have very, very few fruit. Those that have formed because of the hot, dry condition, they may not be the best quality. They may not be the best size. As far as the nuts, like the walnuts, I would assume also they may not fill very well just because of the lack of moisture and the extreme heat. So it may not be a good nut crop either.
And some nut crops anyway tend to be alternate bearing, so they may have produced a nice crop last year and wouldn't have produced a good crop this year anyway.
All right, Randy, thanks a lot for your call. And here's a follow-up to Nisa's question earlier where she was trying to clear an old perennial bed. This is somebody with a suggestion I'd love for you guys to weigh in on. Tim says that he had the same problem, and he overcame it by weed whacking the tops off the vinca, not to the ground, and then immediately spraying. He had to repeat this finally to kill it. According to him, the reason this works is because the shiny leaves of the vinca allow the spray to run off rather than be absorbed. The weed whacking scuffs the surface of some leaves, and they open the edges of other leaves and stems and allow the Roundup to get to the plant.
Well, we were talking about this at the break, too, and we decided that vinca is pretty tough sometimes to get rid of, and sometimes you do have to knock it back in some way to kind of make it more susceptible, I guess, to Roundup. So that covering it with a tarp or covering it, or even tilling it and then coming back with Roundup on what remains might be a great idea. And weed whacking might do that. So, and that might be a little bit easier.
Or add a spreader sticker to the Roundup so the Roundup sticks to the leaves better than just rolling off.
So a couple of options, probably more than one application of Roundup regardless.
Okay. John is on the line next from Minburn. Hello, John.
Hi.
What's your question?
Well, I have a Chinese wisteria that was doing very well, bloomed even after the frost nipped it, it had plenty of blooms, and it gets plenty of water because it's near a bird bath on a trellis. And looked out there the other day, and all of the leaves are dead on it.
Okay, so you're saying the entire vine, all the foliage has wilted.
Is the stem is the stem still green?
I didn't look at it that closely. I can't tell you that.
Well, if all the leaves have wilted, that would suggest a root problem or possibly a vascular wilt. But something is preventing that plant from getting moisture. And that has to mean either a root problem or a vascular wilt. You probably can't do anything, and it's quite likely the plant could be dead. So that's unfortunate.
But you can check that pretty quickly on checking the stems to scratch the surface to see if there's any that's still alive at the top.
Or just wait till next spring and see if it leaves out. But I would be greatly concerned that it may have died, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, thank you very much.
All right, thanks a lot for your call, John. Next up, we'll go to Joan in Cedar Falls. Hi, Joan.
Hi.
What's your question?
Is the Japanese beetle ever going to go away?
that's a short answer. No. unfortunately.
So it's decimated the linden trees for the third year in a row, and this year it got the vine up against my house.
Now, I will say that the populations may vary from year to year. That's very, very likely. But are they going to disappear and never be here again? No, that's not going to happen. So you basically have to deal with them as best you can. But, like I said, some years they may be bad and some years may be not so bad.
So is there anything I can do?
Well, I've always thought that we could capture a bunch of these and make them into jewelry. Because
they
they're a pretty beetle.
But, very good.
But not much else.
Where can they deliver those Japanese beetles, by the way?
Not to me.
And I know someone who actually used Japanese beetles as pizza topping, too.
Okay, so. No, I'm not going there either.
Anyway, on a serious side, you really can't do much as far as the population. You know, some people want to treat their yard. And they do so with the think, well, if I treat my yard, that's going to destroy the grubs, and therefore I'll have fewer Japanese beetles. The problem there is they come from adjacent areas. Your lawn is a tiny speck in the overall landscape, and they're coming from other grassy areas like roadside ditches, parks, pastures, untreated lawns. So even if you treat your lawn, you're not going to see a reduction in the population. Typically, you have to deal with it when they show up. You can use insecticides if you wish. You can pick them off by hand and put them in soapy water. You might want to use maybe very fine net screening to keep them out of certain areas. But you really have to deal with them when they show up.
All right. Well, that's not exactly what you wanted to hear, Joan. Thanks a lot for your call. And Yo also has been experiencing a problem with Japanese beetles, as so many of us have. And Yo in Iowa City. Hi, Yo.
Hello. Yes, I think it's a linden tree that I have. And the Japanese beetles practically ate every leaf on that tree.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like at least 20 feet tall, 30 feet tall. And I'm just wondering, is that tree now dead, or is there anything I can do?
Actually, this is good news. The tree is not dead. The foliage, what remains, may be brown, but the tree is still alive. We have numerous trees, linden trees, on campus here at Iowa State. And late last August, most of them were brown.
Mm-hmm.
But they leafed out perfectly this spring. They were perfectly fine. So it's not life-threatening. It's not a good thing. But the trees do tolerate it. So that's the good news. And so you really don't have to do anything. And hopefully next year won't be as bad.
Right. At the nursery, they told me that I could buy this insecticide, that I could dig a trench around close to the trunk. And in September, I could soak that area very well, and that would be absorbed by the roots.
Yeah,
and then,
Yeah, there is an insecticide. Imidacloprid is the actual active ingredient, and you can apply that as a drench around the tree. You would typically do that in the spring, like in May, and then mm-hmm. the tree roots would absorb that and then move up into the foliage, and you would see far less grub or Japanese beetle damage. I would be inclined to do that if I had a young linden, maybe planted 2 or 3 years, because those trees are not very well established, and the Japanese beetles could cause greater harm. On a well-established tree, I'd be less inclined to use it. But you can, if you wish.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But if you do that, apply that basically like in May.
Okay, in May. Uh-huh. And then I have another quick question. Poison ivy, I have it around. I have a lot of trees, like fir trees, and there's poison ivy everywhere. Mm-hmm. Can I spray for the poison ivy around those trees without harming the trees? And what would be a good insecticide?
Well, Roundup is a non-selective herbicide. It basically kills everything that you spray. So when you use Roundup, you have to be selective in what you apply it to. If the poison ivy is growing on a tree or shrub, I'd be very careful there, because if you get it on the tree or shrub, you can kill that too. What you could do is, if it's growing up a tree, is to cut off the poison ivy near the ground, okay, and then take some Roundup and a foam-type paintbrush, dip the paintbrush in the Roundup, and then dab that on the cut surface of the poison ivy. And that will travel down into the root system and hopefully kill the poison ivy, and you won't have to worry about the tree or shrub.
All right. Yo, good luck with that. And we have time for a few more questions if you'd like to join us at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Vern is on the line next from Des Moines. Hi, Vern.
How you doing?
Good. What's your question?
We planted sod a couple years ago. And this year, with the heat and everything, we've got some great big brown spots. I was thinking that the sod was burnt. My wife wants to dig up the brown spots and go ahead and reseed it, put dirt down, reseed it in the whole shot. But from what I remember when I was a kid, sometimes those brown spots come back in the spring. It's like it's dormant.
Right.
What should we do?
Well, that's the question, are those brown spots dormant or are they dead? And what I would do is, if it doesn't rain this weekend, I would water those brown spots. I would come back next week and water again. I'd come back the next week and water again. And after the third application, if these brown spots are still brown, my guess is they're dead. Because if they're dormant with the moisture, they should green back up. And so if they're dead or still brown in 3 weeks, then at that point, I would try to fix those areas. And if they're small, you can just rake them with a rake and then sow your seed and then rake the seed into the soil and then keep the seed bed moist.
Sounds great.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you much.
Vern, thanks a lot for your call. Next up, we've got Janine on the line in Kelowna. Hi, Janine.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have a red oak that has wind damage. There is a branch that is maybe 8 inches in diameter, and the wind split the branch horizontally. Is it okay to remove that branch now instead of waiting until winter? And if I do remove the branch, do I need to put a coating on the cut surface?
Well, I would remove it at this time, and then as soon as you remove that branch, cut it off, take a latex house paint, and immediately paint the cut surface.
Okay.
Because our concern there is oak wilt.
Right.
The insect is still present, but if you paint that cut surface, that should prevent the insect from being drawn to the area.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call, Janine. You can give us a call at 866-780-9100, 866-780-9100. We probably have time for at least two more calls this hour. And Scott is on the line next from Elkader. Hi, Scott.
Hi, Charity. Hey, Richard, you were talking about clay soils with maple trees earlier, and I know that with the rose bushes that we have, if we put coffee grounds on them, we can neutralize the alkali in the soil a little bit, and I'm wondering if that will help with the maple tree as well.
Well, with a maple tree, the root system is so extensive. It may go out 50 feet from the trunk, and so it's really not very practical to really change the pH. It's very, very difficult.
This is a very young maple tree that I'm trying to get established.
Right.
It's a second generation out of like a sucker coming out of a root ball.
Okay. Well, what kind of maple is it?
I believe a red maple.
A red maple. Well, it's so hard that if the tree does survive, the root system eventually will get extensive. So I don't think I would do anything. And if the tree survives, terrific, great. But if it has some problems, I probably wouldn't take corrective action. I probably wouldn't.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks a lot for your call, Scott. And next up, we've got Ray on the line in Mason City. Hi, Ray.
Hi. 2 years ago, I asked you some questions about transplanting peonies.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they have done real well, but I'm concerned now with the drought we had this year. Should mm-hmm. we be watering them quite a bit? Or?
Well, if it's fairly recently done, yes, watering would probably be a good idea.
Done 2 or 3 years ago.
Yeah, and it's still, we usually say anything with, you know, that hasn't been planted or established for 5 years or less, that's when you need to water, including perennials, because peonies are really prized. So go ahead and make sure they're getting water once a week, once every couple of weeks. You might want to check the soil first. Some people have a heavier clay soil or a sandy soil. And like Richard mentioned earlier, maybe make sure that there's one of those waterings in November, or if we have another warm winter like we did this past winter, you might even be able to go water in January.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
All right, thanks a lot for your call, Ray. And peonies are another thing that I've seen turning brown already.
Yeah.
Do we need to worry if we see our perennials turning brown already this time of year, or is it just...
No, it's an avoidance mechanism. They haven't had a good year. They didn't get a lot of water, and so they're shutting down and going dormant. So it might be an early fall for a lot of trees and for many perennials because they were out really early. As well. I don't think it's any cause for concern. It becomes a cause for concern if it was so dry that they don't come back in spring.
Well, and I remember this spring when we had so many blooms mm-hmm. so early. I think maybe, Cindy, I asked you, does this mean we're not going to have any blooms in August or September? And in a way, it's starting to feel like that.
August is always a tough month for perennials, and because it is kind of in that transition time. And it's been incredibly tough this year because so many things were so early.
Cindy, yep. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Cindy Haynes is an associate professor of horticulture at Iowa State University. Dennis, thank you for being here today.
It was great to be here. Thanks.
Please come back again.
I will.
Dennis Schrock is the new coordinator of the Iowa Master Gardener Program. And Richard, thank you.
You're welcome.
Richard Giron, Iowa State University Extension, will be back with Horticulture Day next Friday. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese and Emily Woodbury. Our executive producer is Jeff Schmidt. Production assistance today from Allison Sullivan. Technical support from Jason Burns in Ames. Podcasting and on-demand audio of Talk of Iowa are available at iowapublicradio.org. You can send us email anytime, talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music was composed and performed by the River Monks. I'm Charity Nebbe. Monday on the show, we're going to talk about voluntourism, traveling the world to do good. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.